Today we're going to begin Joshua chapter 22. Now this chapter could easily and legitimately become a multiple week sermon in addition to a teaching lesson. It is that rich in information and theology and practical application for a believer. But I'm going to focus on just a few of the more important principles contained here. Those I think we as part of the body of modern-day people of God can probably identify with the best. Now, this entire section of Joshua that eventually takes us to the end of the book of Joshua is framed by a concern for those parts of the people of God who live outside of the promised land. Those who live away from Israel proper, away from the sanctuary of God, away from the priesthood of God. But there are also several deep and critical issues, questions that will be asked and answered, and that will be faced by worshipers in every generation, including our current one. And among those questions are, what is the proper worship of God? Where is the proper worship of God to take place? And who are God's people? But for me, the single question, one that is dealt with in this chapter, that has perplexed and annoyed, I think, the church, perhaps as much or more than any other, is this. Does my heartfelt sincerity and good intentions as a disciple of Christ trump God's written and clear laws and commandments? I don't know that we're going to get fully satisfactory answers to just those four of the many questions this exquisite chapter of Joshua raises, but I'm going to, at the least, try and give us grist for the mill, perhaps a framework that we can each think about it. So turn your Bibles to Joshua chapter 22. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 265. Then Joshua called the Reubenites, Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, "You have done everything Moses, the servant of Adonai, ordered you to do and heeded what I said and all the orders I gave to you. All this time you have not abandoned your kinsmen, but have obeyed your commission, as Adonai your God ordered. Now Adonai your God has given rest to your kinsmen, as he told them he would. So you too return to your tents in the land which is your possession, which Moses the servant of Adonai gave you beyond the Jordan. Only take great care to obey the mitzvah, the commandment, and the Torah which Moses the servant of Adonai gave to you, to love Adonai your God, follow his ways, observe his commandments, cling to him, serve him with all your heart and being." Then Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. To the one half-tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given an inheritance in Bashan. To the other half, Joshua gave one among their kinsmen on the west side of the Jordan. When Joshua sent them away to their tents, he blessed them, saying, "Return with great riches to your tents, with very much livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, iron, with great quantities of clothing. Share the spoil of your enemies with your kinsmen." So the descendants of Reuben, the descendants of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh returned. They left the people of Israel in Shiloh, in the land of Canaan, to go to the land of Gilead, to the land they were to possess, and which they already did possess, according to the order of Adonai through Moses. When the descendants of Reuben, the descendants of Gad, the half-tribe arrived in the area of the land of Canaan near the Jordan, they built an altar there by the Jordan, a large, impressive altar. And the people of Israel heard about it and said, "Look, the descendants of Reuben, the descendants of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar by the frontier of the land of Canaan and the area by the Jordan on the side that belongs to the people of Israel." And when the people of Israel heard of it, the entire community of Israel gathered together in Shiloh to wage war against them. The people of Israel sent Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the Kohen, the priest, into the land of Gilead to the descendants of Reuben, the descendants of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And with him were 10 leaders, one leader of an ancestral clan for each of the tribes of Israel. Each one was a head of his ancestral clan among the thousands of Israel. They came to the descendants of Reuben, the descendants of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh in the land of Gilead, and spoke with them, and they said, "Here is what the whole community of Adonai is saying. What is this treachery that you have committed against the God of Israel, turning away today from following Adonai, and that you have built yourselves an altar, thus rebelling today against Adonai? Is the guilt we incurred at Pur not enough for us? We haven't cleansed ourselves from it to this day, even though a plague came on the community of Adonai. Is this why you have to turn away today from following Adonai? If you rebel against Adonai today, he will be angry tomorrow with the whole community of Israel. If the land you have taken possession of is unclean, well, then cross back over into the land which belongs to Adonai, where the tabernacle of Adonai is located, and take possession among us. But don't rebel against Adonai. Don't rebel against us by building yourselves an altar other than the altar of Adonai our God. Didn't Nechan, the son of Zerach, commit a sin in regard to things set aside for destruction? And God's anger fell on the whole community of Israel. He was not the only one who died for his crime. Then the descendants of Reuben, the descendants of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered the leaders of the thousands of Israel. The mighty one, God, is Adonai. He knows, and Israel will know, if we acted in rebellion or treachery against Adonai, don't vindicate us today. We haven't built an altar in order to turn away from following Adonai or to offer on it burnt offerings, grain offerings, or sacrifices as peace offerings. If we have, let Adonai himself require us to atone for it. Rather, we did this out of anxiety because we thought sometime in the future, your descendants might say to our descendants, you don't have anything to do with Adonai, the God of Israel, because Adonai made the Jordan the border between us and you, so you, descendants of Reuben and Gad, have no share in Adonai. In this way, your descendants could make our descendants stop fearing Adonai. So we said, let us now make preparations and build ourselves an altar, not for burnt offerings or sacrifices, but as a witness between us and you, and between our generations who will come after us, so that we may perform the service for Adonai in his presence with our burnt offerings, sacrifices, and peace offerings, so that your descendants will not say to our descendants at some future time, you have no share in Adonai. For this reason, we said, when they accuse us or future generations in this way, we will say, look, here is a replica of the altar of Adonai which our ancestors made, not for burnt offerings or sacrifices, but as a witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against Adonai and turn away today from following Adonai by building an altar for burnt offerings, grain offerings, or sacrifices, other than the altar of Adonai our God, which stands in front of his tabernacle. When Pinchas the Kohen and the leaders of the community, the heads of the thousands of Israel who were with him, heard what the descendants of Reuben, the descendants of Gad, and the descendants of Manasseh said, it satisfied them. Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the Kohen, said to the descendants of Reuben, the descendants of Gad, the descendants of Manasseh, today we know that Adonai is here with us because you have not committed this treasonous act against Adonai. Now you have saved the people from the anger of Adonai. So Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and the leaders returned from the descendants of Reuben and Gad, from the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan, and the people of Israel bringing word back to them. What they said satisfied the people of Israel. The people of Israel blessed God and said no more about going to wage war against the descendants of Reuben and Gad and destroying the land where they lived. The descendants of Reuben and Gad called the altar Eid, a witness between us that Adonai is God. When we ended last time, we saw that the land of Canaan was at rest from war. The land was by no means called Israel yet. The newest residents of the land were just a loose confederation of 12 related tribes. They were not a politically cohesive nation. The huge Israelite army had defeated and destroyed the combined military forces of some northern Canaanite kings, as well as an entire separate army that was the combined military forces of some southern Canaanite kings. Israel had also concluded many peace treaties with other and smaller Canaanite lords and potentates, a thing that was expressly against God's instructions. But it did provide in the short term for a sustained cessation of hostilities. Now, with those more formidable foes of Israel that held most of the Mediterranean coast of Canaan, and with those who also held much of the coastal plain and other clusters of cities and villages scattered throughout the Promised Land, there existed something like what we might call a Cold War going on in Israel. And Israel knew full well that these remaining enemies, well, they were dangerous, they were not to be trusted, and the remaining enemies knew full well that at some point Israel would likely try and annex their territory because Israel's well-known theology demanded it. So this was no military secret. But for both sides, for now, they were satisfied to not be engaged in bloody battles with one another, so they coexisted side by side in an easy but rather uneasy, but nonetheless it was a peaceful arrangement. Well, this lack of hostilities permitted Joshua then to finish dividing up the land among the final seven tribes who had yet to accept their land inheritance. And once that was accomplished, the Levites could now be given cities to live in. And once that was accomplished, the cities of refuge for accidental manslayers could be established and set into operation. And once that was accomplished, there was no need for a combined army of 600,000 men from all 12 tribes of Israel. You know, God is mysterious, almost beyond measure, however, mankind is anything but. Mankind is pretty predictable, fairly simple in our behaviors and our reactions. Our problem is we tend to deny our own predictability. And so history is doomed to repeat itself. The whole series of events had to happen among the Israelites and their Canaanite enemies, all in logical, very visible, customary ways, so that mankind would do what was obvious for him to do as he moved from one typical step to the next. God full well knows all of this. And even though much of what he knows we'll do is wrong, it's cowardly, it's disobedient, it's self-destructive, he still is able to use it to achieve his purposes. This is what was happening in the Promised Land. It was happening then, just like it's still happening in our era today. The initializing event of Joshua 22 is that the troops of Gad, Reuben, and half of the tribe of Manasseh that took their land position on the east side of the Jordan River and the Transjordan are really no longer needed to serve in the army because the reason for their participation, which was the conquest of Canaan, has been accomplished. It's over. So since they have been true to their word, Joshua will be true to the promise he made to them. And that promise is that they may keep the land on the east side of the Jordan River as their own, but they had to send first a sizable number of troops to help the other 9.5 tribes seize Canaan. I want you to turn your Bibles back just a few pages to the beginning of Joshua. Let's read a section of chapter 1, just a short section. chapter 1. We're going to read from verses 10 to the end. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 242. Joshua instructed the officials of the people to go through the camp and order the people, prepare for provisions, because in 3 days you will cross this Jordan to go in and take possession of the land that Adonai your God is giving to you. To the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, remember what Moses, the servant of God, ordered you. Adonai your God has let you rest and will give you this land. Your wives, your little ones, and your livestock will stay in the land Moses gave to you on the east side of the Jordan, but you are to cross over armed as a fighting force ahead of your brothers to help them. Until Adonai allows your brothers to rest as he has allowed you, and they too have taken possession of the land Adonai your God is giving to them. And at that point you will return to the land which is yours and possess it, the land Moses, the servant of Adonai, gave you, and in Aver HaYarden to the east towards the sunrise. They answered Joshua, we will do everything you have ordered us to do, and we will go wherever you send us. Just as we listen to everything Moses said, so we'll listen to you. Only may Adonai your God be with you as he was with Moses. If anyone rebels against your order and does not heed what you say in every detail of your order, he'll be put to death. Just be strong and be bold. So what we see happening in chapter 22 is closure. The book of Joshua begins with the enlisting of Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh to fight alongside their brethren for Canaan. And the book ends with their victory and an honorable discharge from military service. In what must have been some type of a formal ceremony, Joshua tells the three tribes, 2.5 tribes technically, that they've kept their word, they did as Jehovah told them to do, and the result of their obedience is that God has fulfilled his promises in a timely manner. Now, look at Joshua 1:15. There the verse says that the Transjordanian tribes are to remain fighting alongside their fellow Israelites until those other 9.5 tribes have achieved their rest, it says, in the Promised Land, their rest. Therefore, as a fitting conclusion, when we read Joshua 22:4, that now Jehovah your God has given rest to your kinsmen as he told them he would, the circle has been closed. Rest from war was promised and given, so now it's time for these three tribes to go to their homes on the east side of the Jordan, rejoin their families, and those left behind to protect the people in the land to reestablish their economy. Now notice one little thing in verse 4. Joshua says the three tribes may return to their tents. Now this very literal translation points out something we must always be on guard for in the Bible. The sayings of common speech within a culture that don't necessarily mean precisely what they say. The three Transjordanian tribes were not living in tents. They were living in villages and cities and permanent housing. It's just the language of the wanderers. Remember, this was the generation of most of whom were actually born out in the wilderness. They had become, this language had become embedded in their everyday thought, and so they just continued to use words and phrases that Bedouins might use. Just as it is common in our own language to use phrases that really are only understood within our own culture, but we never really think about it. So it was then, so we're going to find lots of it in the Bible. Why do we have to be on guard for it? Because otherwise we're liable to take a string of words as a literal biblical principle, but in fact it was only a common idiom and it meant something else entirely to those who spoke it and heard it. Well, anyway, as part of this decommissioning ceremony, of the three tribes, Joshua enjoins upon them the words of Moses, a goodly part of which comes from Deuteronomy 6, and the blessing known commonly as the Shema, or Shema Israel. And he exhorts the people of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh to always follow the Torah of Moses, to always love Yehovah with all their mind and strength. Now, it's kind of interesting to me that in verse 7, a historical footnote is included in the Hebrew Scriptures that reminds the reader that Manasseh held two separated portions of land, one on the west bank of the Jordan, the other on the east bank. There are a lot of reasons for this that will start to become apparent as we go through this and future lessons as well. But for now, just let me say that without doubt, part of the reason that this was inserted was to answer the third question that I told you at the outset would be addressed in this chapter. And that is, at any given time, who are God's people? Now, as a final kind of combination of exhortation and blessing, Joshua says that the three tribes should take with them livestock, precious metals, and clothing. These items were the spoils of war that they had won in battle. Now, I've mentioned in past lessons that it was the norm for this era that every man was allowed to loot and take valuable items from his defeated enemy. This was in lieu of a paycheck. I can only assume that those items had been authorized by God to go to the soldiers. They were not set apart as God's holy property. In any case, there was an enormous amount of it in their possession. And it was necessary for Joshua to make it clear to the 9.5 tribes that would remain in the promised land that it was okay for these three tribes to take their portion with them when they went home. Now, we have one of those rare kumbaya moments going on here, or so it seems. Everything's good. Everyone seems happy. Goodwill's just flowing. But just underneath all this is a psychology that is completely normal but problematic for humans. Suspicion and mistrust of one another. It's all well and good and gracious to hug and kiss one another and call each other brother and sister when we're together. It's quite another to behave that way when we've parted company. The reality is that beneath the surface of these Israelites simmered an us and them mentality. There was the us of the 9.5 tribes on the one side of the Jordan River, and the them of the 2.5 tribes on the eastern side of the Jordan River. This feeling was mutual, and so it was going to lead to immediate trouble. Home for the 2.5 tribes wasn't far away. It was just a few miles across the Jordan River, but it may as well have been 1,000 miles, because then as now, the Jordan River was not only a naturally occurring geographical boundary that divided territory. See, for them, it was seen as a spiritual boundary. It's important. To the west of the Jordan was the promised land. To the east, well, that was outside of the promised land. Inside the promised land was the earthly dwelling place of God. Outside of the promised land, this God of Israel had no home. Despite the several decades of training and instruction, experiences that all the tribes of Israel had jointly lived out in the presence of Yehovah, the common ways of the world to which they were all too familiar clung to these Hebrews like barnacles on the hull of a ship. They still didn't grasp that there was but one God. They still did not internalize that God has no physical limitations upon him. He observed no territorial boundaries, as did the rest of the world observe for their gods. For the Hebrews, crossing a river meant You're leaving behind the rules and the rulership of one God and on into the authority of another and different one. So suddenly, these Transjordanian tribes of Israelites became anxious. Now that they're leaving Canaan, the promised land, where is their God? Physically, where is their God? Will their brethren on the West Bank allow them to continue participation in the all-important worship rituals? Or are they left out in the cold once they cross over that river and go back home? The religious center of Canaan had been moved to Shiloh in the tribal territory of Ephraim. And as we discussed in previous lessons, this was not a particularly convenient location, even for those tribes who took their land inheritance in Canaan. For those Transjordanian tribes, it was a challenging journey to get to Shiloh, to say the least. Deep in the psyches of the three tribes of the east, they wondered if they'd be remembered, both by the leadership of Israel and by God himself. In fact, they were still under Joshua's authority. Maybe they weren't. Had this discharge ceremony just released them from all submission to Joshua whatsoever? And if they weren't under Joshua's authority, then were they still part of Israel? In other words, while joy was abounding all around, this was a time of transition and anxiety, especially for Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Things were changing, but into what? Now, for you congregation and political and family leaders in the audience, what would you do in this situation? Probably the same thing these three tribes did. They called for a meeting. The leadership got together to discuss the concerns and the agreed solution, at least it was part of the solution, was that they would build an altar to their professed God, Yehovah, a large, impressive one, says verse 10. Not a little stone one as a kind of impromptu memorial, but rather something grand and greatly symbolic, something that would make their people feel better. Now, if you're listening attentively and actually thinking about all of this, a good logical question right about now would be, what in the world does building a grand altar accomplish that comforts those people's worry? Well, guess what? When the leaders of the 9.5 tribes of Canaan found out about it, that was their response too. What could possibly be the purpose of you guys building such a grand altar? To their thinking, it had to be nothing short of those three Transjordanian tribes deciding that they were going to go worship another god now. And in the so doing, break away, declare their independence from all these other tribes of Israel. But just as serious, where'd they build that altar? They built that altar not on the east side of the Jordan River in their own territory. They built it on the west side in Canaan, in the land of promise, in territory that belonged to another tribe, probably Benjamin's. And when the people living in Canaan heard about all this, man, they went ballistic. The tribes that had disbanded their army instantly got it back together. They traveled to Shiloh, the place of the tabernacle, of Joshua's governmental headquarters, and they decided to make war on what they considered their rebellious brethren. The same relatives that had stood shoulder to shoulder on the battlefield for all those years, spilling their blood, giving their lives for another, they were about to go to war among themselves. Now, I could take us a lot of different directions with this one. Look what we do to one another. We'd sooner make war in our own family sometimes than we would with an enemy. Here was Joshua, for the last several years, just just pulling his hair out, trying to get the seven of the Israelite tribes to even accept their free territorial allotment. This was a promised gift from God. But they wouldn't do it. Why? Because it meant battling enemies to finish conquering their territory. Further, each tribe would have had to go it alone, for the most part, because Joshua's army was in the process of disbanding. Each tribe was now only for itself. A brother Hebrew was getting attacked in a neighboring territory. Too bad. His territory is his burden. But let a brother tribe upset you. Have a brother tribe do something that you didn't understand. Guess what happened? All the tribes ganged up. Man, they dropped what they were doing. And they're going to get together and attack the offender. What a lesson for us. In fact, so much of what Yeshua told us to do within church government is modeled after what Joshua and the leadership of Israel did in response to this dangerous situation. When some wanted to take the army, assume the worst intentions of their brethren, and punish the three tribes, and then ask questions later. At Shiloh, Joshua told Pinchas, Eleazar the high priest's son, to go to the leadership of Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh to lodge their complaint and then to investigate this situation. And along with Pinchas went one leader from each of the 10 tribes who were living in the Promised Land. And as an aside, these were not, by the way, the 10 tribal princes. Rather, they were 10 chosen clan leaders, one from each tribe, who were to go and represent the whole tribe. They went as a delegation, if you would, to the east side of the Jordan River in the land of Gilead, and there they confronted the Transjordanian tribal leadership. The delegation accused the three tribes of treachery. The building of that altar was at the heart of the problem. At least the stated concern of the delegation was that building that altar was a terrible affront to Yehovah, and that every Israelite would wind up being punished for it. And they go on to give the historical examples of Achan, who took some spoils of war at Jericho that they were supposed to be only devoted to God. And then the event of the at Baal Peor, when Israel committed idolatry and said that if only the three tribes who built that altar suffered for this sin, that would be one thing. But God has shown that all Israel will suffer for such enormous offenses against him. In the case of Baal Peor, 24,000 Israelites died by divine plague. In the case of Achan, his entire household was wiped out. And divine wrath. What might God do to the 12 tribes if they allowed the atrocity of knowingly allowing worship at an unauthorized altar built in an unauthorized place by unauthorized people? In other words, it is a well-established God principle that while communal guilt might not be established upon all for the sins of one, communal burden will be established when God's holiness is attacked, and it was caused by the negligence or the inaction or the willful ignorance of the group. See, it's not that Achan's family sinned, as Achan did. It's that they suffered because of their association with Achan, and thus they were burdened with the consequences of Achan's sin. Pinchas and the 10 leaders from Canaan may have been concerned to some degree for the well-being of their Transjordanian brother tribes, but they were terrified for themselves, for their families. And rightly so, I might add. They had learned those hard lessons in very devastating fashion. Well, then in verse 19, the delegation asks the leaders of the three tribes a very penetrating, in some way sarcastic question. Hey, guys. If you believe that this land that you possess, of course meaning the Transjordan, is unclean, so that you wouldn't build an altar there, Well, then cross back over into the land that belongs to Jehovah that was set apart for his people. I mean, I have to tell you that a Christian philosopher could make a doctoral thesis out of this question and what all is behind it. See, in a nutshell, the gist of it's this. The three tribes of the East say that they want to be identified with Israel. And of course, the God of Israel. They're worried that such an identity might get taken away from them. But when they respond by building this illegitimate altar, not in their own land, but across the Jordan River back in the Promised Land, so if they want their own land to be sanctified, if they want their land and the people living in their land to be associated with those who live in the Promised Land, why wouldn't they build their altar in their own land for their own people to see? And in a kind of sarcasm, the questioner provides his own answer to what's really just a rhetorical question by saying that the three tribes must view then their own land as unclean. Defile. Conclusion. Well, so if you think your land's unclean, the land you chose, by the way, then that you won't even build your altar there. How can you possibly consider permanently living there? Then the questioner, which I suspect is Pinchas, considering the subject is the altar, he's a priest, continues by saying effectively, you're completely welcome to move into the Promised Land along with the rest of your brethren. We will carve out sufficient territory from our own to accommodate you. Now, this is a very generous offer. But then again, only a man with authority over more than his own tribe could ever make that kind of an offer. All the more reason to suspect that the person doing most of the talking is Pinchas, a very important and revered priest. Now, of course, underlying this question about the uncleanness of the Transjordan land is a mountain of innuendo. For the priest Pinchas to openly suggest that maybe the land of the Transjordan is unclean for these three tribes is probably intended to confirm the worst fears so perplex the minds of those Israelites living there. I mean, since the land they have chosen is not the Promised Land, and they understand that, then perhaps Jehovah's not going to be there with them. And if he's not with them, then perhaps they'll not receive his blessing or his protection. And if God is not there, then it must be because the land is not sanctified. I mean, this is a really serious problem that they're facing, assuming that their fears are valid. I mean, this concept of living on non-sanctified land, this is going to surface again. Hundreds of years later, when the residents of Judah are exiled to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, and they deal with the problem of trying to live a Torah-observant lifestyle in a pagan place, on defiled land, breathing defiled air, eating defiled food, because the God of this land is a Babylonian God and not Jehovah. Therefore, they live in Babylon, in a perpetually defiled condition, outside the Promised Land, with no temple to worship, no priesthood, no altar to atone for their sins. What a situation. I can't stress enough something that I've talked to you about on a number of occasions. The 9.5 tribes lived in the Promised Land by their own choice. The 2.5 tribes lived outside the Promised Land by their own choice. Now, it was not sin, per se, that the 2.5 tribes chose the Transjordan as their home. In fact, Moses, apparently God too, allowed it without so much as any kind of a warning that's ever been recorded. However, this decision put them in a precarious situation. God had promised a land of special blessing and protection for his people, accompanied with his personal presence. But here were some who claimed to be his people, three tribes, and they decided it was more economically advantageous to live near the Promised Land, but not in it. people who said no thanks to God's provision.
Yeah,
you want to give me this? I don't want that. I want this over here. They think a place of their choosing is better than the place of his choosing. And on the surface, who could argue with it? Well, at the same time, Reuben and Gad and Manasseh certainly wanted the same blessings. They wanted the same blessings afforded by God's presence as their brothers that were living in the promised land. They wanted those blessings to be added to the perceived advantages that they saw of living in the Transjordan outside the promised land. Now, after having spent some years in the promised land fighting, spilling their blood, they sensed something different about Canaan than any other place. But the pull of these worldly advantages of living in the Transjordan just seemed to trump what they knew deep down they ought to do. They ought to move into the land of the divine Father's rest and provision that he'd been preparing for them since Abraham. So they apparently thought, maybe we can get around this problem. They would just build an altar to Yahweh, their own altar, inside the promised land, and somehow that would buy them something of his favor in their land. So I have a question for you all. Is that how you live your life? Do you see the blessing of the promised land and want it? Of course. But the pull of the world outside of the promised land is just too great to resist. Just too great to resist. You think, you know, if I play this right, maybe I can have both. Maybe I can receive the blessings of those who live within the boundaries of God's kingdom while I live outside of it. It never worked out very well for those three tribes of the Transjordan. Their land blessings were very short-lived. And they also didn't get the blessing of living near to God. Luke 16:13. No servant can be a slave to two masters. For he will either hate the first and love the second, or scorn the second and be loyal to the first. You can't be a slave to both God and money. Beginning in verse 21. The tribal leaders of Reuben and Gad and Manasseh respond to the accusations from Pinchas, and the tone is that they're utterly flabbergasted by they hear. And they explain, whoa, this is all one big misunderstanding. No way are they contemplating worshiping another god. Nor, just as important, are they planning on actually sacrificing on that altar that they built. In typical Middle Eastern fashion, they begin their defense of their actions by glorifying God's name to show their continuing dedication to him. Our complete Jewish Bible says that the Transjordanian tribal leadership proclaimed, "The mighty one God is Adonai." Other versions say God, the Lord God. Still others say the Lord is God of gods. In Hebrew it says El Elohim Yehovah. The gist of this is that by saying El Elohim, it is making clear that they are speaking of the highest God of all gods. By saying Yehovah, they are saying that Yehovah is the highest God of all those gods. So it leaves no doubt to any listener that they can put to rest any thought that their intention is to change gods. And further, they say that they've not committed rebellion against Yehovah. And they also didn't build an altar with the intent to sacrifice upon it. Now, although the English translations kind of ruin the drama and the detail of it, they say they are not going to do Ola, Mincha, or Shlamim sacrifices. Those three named sacrifices are representative of the entire range of Levitical sacrifices from the mandatory to the voluntary, from sacrificing animals to offering produce. Thus, it makes clear that no kind of sacrifice is going to be performed on that altar. At least that was their intention. So what's the big deal if they did build that altar, not meaning to sacrifice to another god, but they fully intended to perform Torah-ordained sacrifices upon it to Jehovah, even though they denied it? Let's recall several rules contained in the law about this subject. Sacrifices were to occur only upon the great altar at the tabernacle. Only God's appointed Levite priests were to perform sacrifices. The place of the tabernacle, and thus the altar, was only one place, and it had to be where God directed it to be. That place, as of this time, was Shiloh. There were many other associated commandments that made it a terrible offense to sacrifice on any other altar, using any other procedures, even if the intent was to sacrifice to Jehovah. Rather, the three tribal leaders explained, their motive was that they were worried that once they left the promised land and returned to the Transjordan, they would no longer be considered as God's people, as Israelites. And thus, they would not be included as beneficiaries of the Levitical sacrifices and rituals. They were especially afraid that as time passed, future generations came and went, that those Israelites who lived in Canaan would deny that Reuben and Gad and Manasseh ever aided the 9.5 tribes in their conquest, or even that they were all part of the same people and nation, Israel, worshiping the same God, Jehovah. So they built this altar not as a place of sacrifice, but as a monument of remembrance. Or better, as it puts it, a witness to their loyalty to the God of Israel and to their own heritage. Pinchas and the Israelite leadership accepted their explanation. They go back to Canaan, tell the people, and thank God, war is averted. We're going to continue with chapter 23 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.